This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Brian Wagner at the controls. Just a quick mention, tomorrow morning in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with the man we like to call our chef in residence. Doyle Moore is his name. He's been stopping by once a month on the first Wednesday of the month, and we talk about cooking. We always have a good time. So that's tomorrow at 10. In the second hour, we will look at the issue of racial profiling and Asian Americans. We'll have two guests, both of them from the university, George Yu, who is head of Asian American Studies and professor of political science, and Palasana Balgopal. He is an emeritus professor of social work here at University of Illinois. That's tomorrow morning at 11. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and always welcome your calls and questions. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, most commonly referred to by its initials, ADHD, is the most commonly diagnosed behavioral disorder of childhood. It is estimated to affect between 3 and 5% of all school-age children in this country. However, there's a great deal of controversy surrounding ADHD, what it is, its causes, and how it might be best treated. And one of the biggest controversies involves the use of the stimulant drug Ritalin, and that and other stimulant medications to treat it. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dr. Peter Breggin. He's one of the world's leading critics of biological psychiatry, including psychiatric drugs, and he's written a lot on this issue. He's a psychiatrist with a full-time private practice in Bethesda, Maryland. He's also founder and international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. That's a reform-oriented research and educational network. He's the author of a dozen books, just to name a couple. Toxic Psychiatry, he published that in 1991. Beyond Conflict in 1992, and one that's for which he's maybe best known, a book titled Talking Back to Prozac. That book was published in 1994. He's also written about Ritalin in a book titled Talking Back to Ritalin that was first published in 1998. It now is out in a new, updated edition with new material in there. The book is Talking Back to Ritalin, What Doctors Aren't Telling You About Stimulants and ADHD. It's published by Perseus Books. It is in paperback, so it's not terribly expensive. And if this is something that interests you, you can head down to the bookstore or possibly to the library and look for the book. And as we talk this morning with Peter Breggin, of course, your questions and comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Breggin, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for that very nice and detailed introduction.
Well, I appreciate you giving us the time. How many people, and I know it's not just children, how many people in the United States today are taking Ritalin or perhaps something like it?
Yeah, I think it's important to establish that Ritalin is not even the dominant drug anymore. It's been to some extent replaced by Adderall, which is actually a mixture of amphetamines, which many parents don't know, so that a parent goes and says, hey, I've heard bad things about Ritalin, so the doctor says, well, here's something else, Adderall, which is actually at least as dangerous and in some ways perhaps more dangerous because it's the plain old-fashioned amphetamines, whereas Ritalin is more amphetamine-like, not totally exactly the same. And we don't know how many people are taking these drugs, but certainly an estimate for children up to age 18 would be 4 or 5 million, maybe more, and we don't know the numbers of adults, but it's we're in the multiple millions. Some school districts that have been surveyed before we had so many long-acting drugs and the nurses had to give them was showing that up to 15% of boys in the fourth, fifth grade area were taking these drugs at school. So it's very hard to know, but it's very significant. Many classrooms that you'll visit today will have 20 or 30% of the boys on these drugs. And if you go to a school that specializes in kids with difficulties, you may find 100% are on psychiatric drugs. And it's way beyond just these stimulants, because the stimulants cause adverse effects, which doctors don't appreciate, such as depression. They can cause obsessive-compulsive disorder. They cause psychotic symptoms. And then what happens is the children end up on other drugs, multiple other drugs. And in July, People magazine told the story of one of my kids that I took off four or five psychiatric drugs, and it all began with Ritalin. So the problem is that Ritalin becomes a gateway drug to other psychiatric drugs. And finally, we have studies showing that kids who use these drugs prescribed fashion are cocaine abuse prone, more prone than other kids with the same diagnosis who didn't get these drugs when they get older. And that shouldn't be a surprise, because animals, addicts, cross-addict to Ritalin and amphetamine and cocaine and so on. So these are very serious drugs.
Well, there has been controversy for some time now surrounding the use of stimulants for ADHD. I guess now this to me is something new, the idea that there are significant numbers of children that are taking multiple psychoactive drugs. Do you have any number that you can put on that?
No, we don't have a number, although you know, there was a study that was published in the AMA Journal of 2 to 6-year-olds and found that a number of them were also on multiple drugs. I don't know of any figures on it, nor of how anyone would collect figures on it, but it is very, very common now. I'm seeing many children on 4 and 5 psychiatric drugs, and their parents forget that the kids were actually getting worse with each drug, because the doctors confuse them and say, oh, now your son's mania is, your bipolar disorder or manic depressive disorder is emerging, or now your son's depressive disorder or your son's OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder is emerging, when in fact, it's just a flat-out adverse reaction to the drugs. But no, we don't have data. The United States does not collect data on things like this, but there's no question about the trend. It's a trend with adults, too, now, the multiple psychiatric medicating. And there's no studies that confirm the usefulness of multiple medications. In the case of kids, the studies are very weak, even though there have been hundreds of them. I mean, basically, they show that Ritalin suppresses behavior, or the stimulants suppress behavior in kids. And they do that by causing harm to the brain. It's not like it's fixing the brain. If you give stimulants to a normal, healthy chimpanzee or any other animal, it just crushes spontaneous behavior. Curiosity, exploration, socialization, play is obliterated in animals by these drugs. And basically, I feel like we're making, and I think the science confirms, we're making good caged kids. When we give them these drugs, they're easier to handle, they're easier to manage, but it's at the cost of their spontaneity.
Real quick here, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Peter Breggin. He is a psychiatrist with a private practice in Bethesda, Maryland. He's also founder and international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, and has written a number of books on the issue of biological psychiatry, particularly psychiatric drugs. And here we're talking about just one of the things that he has written about, that is the use of stimulant drugs like Ritalin, for children who are diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. And he's written a book on this that first came out some years back, but now is out in a new revised edition. The title of his book is Talking Back to Ritalin, and it's published by Perseus Books. Is in the bookstores if you'd like to look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about ADHD itself, because I think that there's here the surrounding the very question of what it is, there's a lot of controversy. It's diagnosed by looking at a long list of symptoms, and I guess the more symptoms you can identify in the child, the more certain you are of the diagnosis. Is that basically it?
Well, yes. It's sort of like the old Chinese restaurant menu that's maybe beyond the age of many folks who are listening, but there used to be choose one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. And it's that kind of thing, and it has about as much validity. One of the few things I read on the radio and at meetings is the actual diagnostic criteria, because to hear them is to shame the entire idea of the diagnosis. The diagnosis is divided up into three parts: inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. And basically, it's a list evolved over years of everything that annoys teachers and requires attention in class. That is the single thing that holds the list together, is that this is disruptive of a classroom. Under hyperactivity, the number one diagnosis, the number one criteria, this is in the official American Psychiatric Association Diagnostic Manual, number one, often fidgets with hands or feet or squirms in seat. So here's the teacher watching this kid squirming in seat and wishing she could do something about it. The second one under hyperactivity is often leave seat in classroom. The first one under impulsivity I love because I'm very guilty of it. Often blurts out answers before questions have been completed. I mean, that's how you win on Jeopardy and these other shows. And then under inattention, the first one is often fails to give close attention to details or makes a careless mistake in schoolwork. Now, what could hold a list like that together? It is not a biological disease. I mean, these things are normal behaviors. They're not symptoms like a rash. They're normal behaviors. And even if they're occurring in a lot or in excess or disrupting a classroom, that doesn't make them a disease. It means you have to understand, why is this happening? And, of course, a child who's squirming in his seat or blurting out answers or not paying attention could be a boring teacher, too large a classroom. Child could be behind in class. The child could have a genuine physical illness, not a made-up one like ADHD. The child could be hungry or have a brain injury or be tired from not sleeping at night. Quite often these kids are experiencing a lot of conflict at home, which is upsetting them, and often they just have boring teachers in too large classrooms. I've seen kids with these diagnostic behaviors, that is these normal behaviors, but occurring at a high enough rate or intensity to cause a teacher and a psychologist or a pediatrician to diagnose them. I've seen these kids have none of these behaviors when they change teachers, or none of them when they change schools, or none of them as soon as the parents get a little help in how to better discipline a child. So we're doing a huge disservice to our wonderful children, and often our most wonderful, our most energetic, creative kids, by looking at their energy and suppressing it with drugs that can harm the brain and do harm the brain. A lot of documentation in my book, Talking Back to Real, on outright brain damage caused by these drugs. And we're doing this to the kids instead of looking at all their energy and saying, oh, these are our best kids, our future heroes, our future kids who stand up under stress, our future innovative kids. And let's just channel this energy, find new ways to approach it, better ways to teach them and raise them. Instead of doing that, we blame the kids and drug them. And I think it's a national tragedy.
I guess one of the things that I think is that, having done some reading on the subject and talk with some people who have children who have been diagnosed as ADHD, I think they would say that this notion that the problematic behaviors of their children are just normal childhood behavior, they think they would say, look, I know the difference between what's normal and what's not, and that I've had a child here who really has behavioral problems that makes them difficult, if not impossible, to live with. And I think further they would say, at least some of the people I've talked to would say, that when their children were prescribed these medications, or particularly Ritalin, they would have said that it was nothing short of a miracle what happened to their child. And in the terms of the ability of that child to have a normal life, to manage to work and live within the school environment, to do the schoolwork, and to be a child that you can actually, you know, get along with and live with. And I think they would say that they'd fight you tooth and nail if you came and you tried to take the medication away from them and their children.
Yes, in fact, they can get quite outraged and quite angry, some of these parents, when they hear a critique like this. Two issues. One, sure, there are kids who are terribly out of control, but I've never had a child who couldn't come under control in 1 hour in my office. In the most extreme cases, I bring in one of my old arthritic dogs and explain to the child that if they're going to pet it, they really have to calm down. And you'll see this child who supposedly cannot control herself or himself under any conditions calming down to sit on the floor and pet the dog. So then I'll say to the parent, well, it can't be a brain disease like you've been told, or it wouldn't go away when the need came up to pet a dog. And the parent will say, well, of course, I knew she does or he does fine with her computer. It's just under certain circumstances. So it's a disease of certain circumstances. Well, what are the circumstances? Certainly, kids can be terribly out of control. In my own experience, it doesn't take long sitting with a family to see why they're having trouble controlling their child. Quite often, the parents can't agree on what behaviors to control. quite often, one of the parents perhaps had a very hard childhood and decided she'd never be rough on her kids, so she's too permissive. The other parent may be too domineering. Often you see the parents having really terrible conflict about the child and how to raise the child. At other times, the child has been abused somewhere, not necessarily at home, but we know that a tremendous amount of child abuse takes place in our society. There's a lot of abuse by kids of each other at school. There's just lots and lots of things that could go into making a kid unruly and very, very difficult. So while the behaviors are essentially normal or developmental that we're looking at, yes, they can get so out of control that the child's in distress and so is everybody else. But that doesn't turn it into a disease. That just means we have a very undisciplined, very unruly child. And the answer is for parents to redouble and teachers and counselors to redouble their efforts to reach this child, communicate with this child, and help this child calm down. And I've literally never found a child, I'm sure I could on some occasion, but I've never found a child that I couldn't calm down. It's not true of, say, kids who are severely autistic. They come into the office. You're not necessarily going to reach them. There are kids who are very, very hard to reach at times. But the kids who have these behaviors, these kids, I mean, as soon as they sense that there's an authority present who's serious and caring, they tend to calm down.
We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and so we will start talking with people who are listening. People can help us out if you just try to be brief, just so we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. We'll start out, though, with a caller in Aurora. This is line number 4. Hello.
My daughter started to teach a class of this type of student a month ago when school started. They have 3 to 5 students now. They can never have more than 7 students in the classroom. She's a teacher. She has 2 aides. They can't get another aide, so she only has 1 aide. There's a policeman right by. The room is by the principal's office. I understand burnout is very fast. I don't know how long the average teacher lasts in a class like this. My question to you, and I will hang up, how long have you taught this type of student? Thank you.
Well, I'm not an elementary school teacher and or a high school teacher. When I teach in general, if kids are fidgeting or adults are fidgeting, I assume I'm not getting their attention. But the question that this woman raises really is, what is these kind of kids? They're the kids who we diagnose with ADHD and load up with drugs are not the sort of children that generally require or ever get 3 adults taking care of a group of 5 to 6 or 7 with a policeman standing by. That's more like your severely emotionally disturbed children that she's describing, and that certainly isn't something that's going to be particularly helped by Ritalin or Adderall. There are very emotionally disturbed kids, and they just need a lot of attention and a lot of help. As for teacher burnout, I think that in general our classrooms are not teacher-friendly or student-friendly, and I'd be the first to say that the more typical circumstance of one teacher with no teacher's aid teaching 25 to 30 kids, which is really your typical situation, is very unfair to a modern teacher. Classrooms without the kind of technology that entertain kids and interest them in education. So teacher burnout, I have teachers in my practice, and they do get very burned out under the expectations now that are demanded of them. But to say that that's a reason to drug our kids is unethical and tragic. What we need to do is make it possible for our teachers to enjoy teaching again, which means smaller classes, more interesting schools, more individualized education, and a lot more insistence that children be respectful. You walk into an average school today, and children are routinely doing things that would have led to you being expelled when I was going to school. I go to an auditorium and see 35, 40, 50 kids carrying on in a way that any one of them would have been sent home if they'd done that back in the 50s. So part of what we need to do is to really develop schools where we can supervise our kids, help them be respectful, prevent them from abusing each other. But the circumstance this woman called in about her her daughter, maybe, you know, she's not teaching kids with ADHD. She's sounds like she's in some sort of severely emotionally disturbed classroom.
Hmm. Let's go to another caller. This is Clark County, and it's line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. 5 years ago, my now teenage son began on very low doses of Ritalin. Today, he's basically a walking pharmacy, including Zoloft, Concerta, something else I don't even know. But I'm a divorced non-custodial parent. This concerns me a lot. Is there any hope down the road of my child being weaned off of these drugs?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I do in my practice is wean people off of psychiatric drugs. It's very hard to find professionals willing to do it because medical doctors have been brainwashed to a great extent so that they know how to start you on five drugs without any scientific basis, but they don't know how to wean you off. But yes, my book, Your Drug May Be Your Problem, talks about how to go about weaning people off of medications and can help a family and professionals in that process. Yes, people can be weaned off of multiple psychiatric drugs. They need in that process often to have some good counseling, to have family involved, to go very slow. And it often involves weaning off of the most recent drug first, but not always. And then, you know, the drugs you've been on the longest or the hardest, usually, but not always. So there are some general principles that you can develop. And maybe if your son, he's old enough now, read some books about that were critical of drugs, he'd get a more balanced view, because probably all he's been hearing is the pro-drug propaganda.
Well, okay, and real briefly, being a non-custodial parent, is there any hope of me intervening in the situation and working towards weaning him from these drugs?
Well, I thought your son was a little older than that. How old is he?
13.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had a misunderstanding from what you said. We have had some success in going to court, especially when children are on multiple drugs that often, like Zoloft, isn't approved for a 13-year-old. The FDA doesn't approve it for 13-year-olds. There's no antidepressant is approved for youngsters. They tend to cause more harm than good. So there are opportunities at times to go to court about these issues. Again, especially when there are multiple drugs and drugs that are not even FDA approved, but there's no guarantee of winning, and it can be a very costly and difficult process. The best thing to do would be to consult an attorney about it.
And, I've got to hang up now. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call. We are already at our midpoint. Let me again very quickly introduce again our guest. Then we have other callers. We're talking with Dr. Peter Breggin. He is a psychiatrist in full-time practice in Bethesda, Maryland. He is one of the world's leading critics of biological psychiatry, including psychiatric drugs. He's founder and international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, and has authored a number of books, including one we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Talking Back to Ritalin. It is an updated and revised version of a book that was first published in 1998. The new one here is available in paperback, published by Perseus. So we're here and open to whatever questions you might have. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. The next caller in line is in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi. I've got two questions, and I'll just hang up and listen. Back in the spring, I believe, in Newsweek magazine, there was an article about some doctor, I think, in California who purports to have shown on brain scans that there are six or seven kinds of ADD, and depending upon what kind you have, it affects different parts of the brain. And there were these color, you know, diagrams in the magazine. I'm sure you saw this. And I'm wondering what you have to say about those findings. I'm also curious about some people's contention that if a kid has ADD and it's not treated, then at some point they'll try and self-medicate by taking illegal drugs.
They're good questions. I answer them both in great detail in Talking Back to Ritalin with scientific documentation. But briefly, the brain scans I call the brain scan scam, because in fact no one has found any abnormalities in the brains of these kids unless they've had serious courses of psychiatric drugs, which we know can change and damage the brain. And at the big consensus conference here in November 98, where I was the scientific presenter on adverse drug effects that the U.S. government put on, the person who put up these things and made these claims with these color photographs had to admit that all of these cohorts of children have been on psychiatric drugs. And we know from animal studies that these drugs can actually kill brain cells. These are very serious drugs. And the use of the color is terribly misleading. It's kind of like the temperature chart on the back of USA Today, where red means 95 degrees and yellow means 80 degrees or whatever. But it's actually just a matter of degree. The colors don't represent qualitatively different areas. They're just representing degrees of activity in the brain. And even if an ADHD kid, that is a kid who's jumping all around, may be more active in one area of the brain than the other, well, you'd expect that. Just like when you look at a photograph, your areas in your that are visual would be more active than the areas that are verbal. No one has ever shown any brain abnormality in association with this. Your other thing about the kids will grow up and have more problems and be seriously disturbed and use drugs if they're untreated. This is actually a lie. Both these things reach the proportions of fraud. When you look at the studies, they were actually of kids given Ritalin. The studies of bad outcomes were at clinics, where research clinics where the children were actually given stimulant drugs. Nonetheless, if your child is very badly out of control, of course that doesn't speak well for the future. If your child is terribly out of control, you want to do everything in your power to help your child get under control before they reach adolescence and really can cause harm to themselves and other people. But you see, we forget that that's sort of obvious. I mean, it is sort of obvious. It doesn't prove anything about ADHD or anything about drugs. It just says that, yeah, if your kid's really acting up at age 7 or 8 and banging other kids or running around totally out of control, you want to work very hard to help that child grow up better.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. One thing I guess I'm still curious about here, we talked about the fact that there may well be millions, and no one knows precisely how many, children
right.
and also adults taking stimulant medications, Ritalin and others, for ADHD. And I find myself wondering whether we might say, well, maybe that's way too many, but that some of them, I don't know, a quarter, a half, a tenth, some percentage of them actually do benefit from taking those medications, if indeed they're only taking that specific medication and in a relatively low dose.
Well, you know, what does benefit mean? There is no question whatsoever that giving stimulants for a period of maybe 4 or 8 weeks, we don't know much beyond that, but before 8 weeks, will take the edge off a child's spontaneity and produce either a very subtle loss of spontaneity or, depending on a child's reaction, all the way up to what's called robotic behavior. There's no doubt that you can do that to a child, but is it good? I think it's scientifically wrong. I think it's wrong in principle. There's many things we could do to kids. We could hit them in the head, and by God, that would improve their behavior for a few weeks, too. And we can give them alcohol. Many kids take alcohol, marijuana, to calm themselves down and go to school when they're in their teens. But psychoactive substances are not the answer to our children's problems. And, which kid are you going to do? All the kids I meet, I'm able to help by working with the school and the family. And I can't say that for, again, a child who is severely disturbed. But we're talking about the kids that fit the ADHD diagnosis. They're just out of control. They haven't learned self-discipline. All of these things are lists of out-of-control behaviors. Fails to give attention, talks out of turn, fidgets with hands or feet. These are kids who haven't learned to settle down. And it's a question of providing them an environment that engages them and teaching them to settle down. And I don't think there's any excuse for doing it by drugging their brains.
Let's go again to the phone. So the next caller in line would be in Champaign, and it's line number 3.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah. This goes back. You kind of already asked the question. I was saying I think there's actually needs to be a middle ground here, because there are some children who seem to be very unresponsive to, let's say, more social interventions. And I kind of agree. I think that ADHD is much over-diagnosed, because I have a child that is very active and needs to have his activities channeled elsewhere. And I think some of this deals with educational policy. Again, like you said, the classroom's overcrowded, but, you know, classrooms are overcrowded throughout the ages. I went to school in the 60s, and classrooms were overcrowded, but I think a lot of teachers knew how to deal with active kids a little bit better, because sometimes you need to channel that activity. For instance, you can have a kid come up and erase the board. You can make the kid sit up in the front of the classroom. It's different things that you could do, and I know that I'm going to make teachers upset about that by saying this, but I think some of this is we're expecting too much civility from the children, and I just want to listen to what your comments are on that.
All right. Dr. Bragan?
Well, I'm in a perfect agreement with all those observations except the one where there are some kids. Believe me, you leave open the some kids, and then there are some doctors who are going to drug all their kids and say, oh, well, I get the some kids. You'd be surprised how many doctors are out there saying, well, I get the ones who do need drugging, so I drug 100% of my kids. It's a door we don't need to open, and the fact that some children are having more trouble responding to what your caller calls social interventions just means we need to work a little harder on the social interventions. In effect, you see, we're declaring some of our kids incorrigible, unreachable by human effort. And I just don't think that's the right answer for children who have out-of-control behaviors.
I suppose some people, forgive me for raising the point, but some people would say that in your practice, what you're seeing is a non-representative sample, because you're seeing the worst cases. And that maybe there are children out there who are managing to do okay, maybe with a little bit of medication, maybe they have good parents, and that in fact that it's possible to make it work, but that when it goes wrong and they need professional help, that you're the kind of guy they're going to seek out.
Well, I actually see a broad range. I see people who are on multiple meds. I see parents who've been warned that they should put their kid on meds, and then they come to me to get a second opinion or somebody to stand up to the school. So I see quite a range. I think I see some more severe than other doctors, but ironically, those are the ones that are supposed to need the medicine, and those are the ones that I end up taking off four or five meds, and they're doing better than ever when they come off.
Hmm. Do you find that many people come to you and say, the school says my child should be on this medication, and I'm just not so sure about it?
Yeah, that's probably most of the parents I see. The schools are the main avenue for intimidating people into putting their children on drugs. And, of course, we have these new laws in Connecticut and coming out elsewhere that tell teachers not to recommend drugs, but they can still recommend evaluations, and those usually lead to drugs in today's climate, unfortunately. But, yeah, I'm seeing a lot of cases where the parents are intimidated and they need a second opinion to stand up to the school. And sometimes it's a very easy situation. I had some parents come to me last spring with only a month and a half left of school, and their child was in a private school and they liked the public school. And I said, why don't you just take your child out right now and put him in the public school? And they said, gee, with only a month and a half left? I said, look, he's got a teacher who thinks he's mentally ill. That's not good for him. So they took him out, and the new teacher didn't have a single problem with the child. Mm-hmm. Same child, same town, different teachers in different schools. Second teacher had no problem at all. And that's the mild cases. When you have the more mild cases, then it's really obvious that all you need is a change of classroom or a change of teachers or some discipline. So when the kid's really, really out of control, that you have to work very, very hard to get all the adults in the child's life to kind of rally around that kid and be firm and loving at the same time and set some reasonable limits and do it consistently and do other common sense interventions that we've always relied on for thousands of years before we were told that they didn't work, you need the drug kits.
Let's talk with another caller here, line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I am a teacher for 3- and 4-year-olds who've been labeled at risk. And I have parents coming to me regularly saying, do you think she's hyper? Do you think, you know, what about Ritalin and that sort of thing? And I feel as against it as your guest today, but I'm not really sure what to tell. I mean, what I tell them often is, you know, she's three. When you're three, it's not natural to sit still all the time. When you're three, it's natural to run around and have lots of energy and be excited. But I don't know, you know, how to dissuade parents from this or where to send them for more information.
Well, God bless you. May I ask a question? How do you get a classroom of 3 to 4 year olds at risk? How is that classroom constructed?
I'm not sure exactly how the people know, but
private school.
How? I'm sorry.
Private school.
He was asking you where it is do you teach? Not that you have to tell us, but is it private school, public school?
It's through a grant. It's the Get Ready grant.
Okay.
Is that sort of...
Right. You know, it's a tough problem because you're going against all the propaganda. It's the main reason I wrote Talking Back to Ritalin is for exactly these situations, for parents to be able to read a book that talks about why don't do the drugs and then has several chapters on different approaches. One of the questions you can ask the parents, if you want to, you know, risk getting a little more involved, is are the same behaviors at home as you're concerned about in school? Are you feeling your child's hyper at home? And if so, then you could recommend that they just go to the local Barnes & Noble or Borders and get some good books on how to raise kids. Parent effectiveness training books are good, but there's a whole range of them. Or that they, find a counselor who doesn't believe in drugs to talk to them about parenting or take a parenting class. One of the important distinctions about behaviors like this when they're out of control is, are they occurring at home or just in the school, or just in the home and not at the school? Because it tells you about where you need to address the problem. And if the parents are having discipline problems, which essentially this is, we forget what these are. If you're having discipline problems at home, then you need to get together with your both parents and maybe the grandparents and anybody else who caretakes and do some reading and thinking about a consistent plan of discipline and caring.
Thanks very much.
Keep up your spirit. It's going to be hard.
We'll go next to line number two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to give a scenario of some relatives. There are four children in one family who are on Ritalin. And, of course, we're not too fond of that. But and also the oldest one now has Tourette's syndrome. They seem to be okay, but they're just very passive, flopsy kind of kids. So do you have any comments on that?
Are these four kids being raised by a mom without a dad?
No, it's a family.
It's a family? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sad situation. Just imagine a family where the parents have so given up on the idea of raising their kids successfully that they've got them all on drugs. And I think it may be the same doctor who's telling them it's genetic when it's not even a disease, so it's certainly not genetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a sad situation, and what can one say about it other than that? And the drugs tend to make kids passive, the stimulant drugs.
What about the Tourette's syndrome? Is that a...
Tourette's is caused by stimulant drugs. Tourette's is where you have tics, usually of the face, and then really technically to be Tourette's, you're supposed to be vocalizing in some way, you know, cursing or letting out a single word or something. But often we just call it Tourette's now if there's some twitches. And in fact, all the stimulant drugs produce twitches. Most of the time they go away when the drug is stopped, but they can become permanent. In fact, I have in my practice a young man who has a permanent, slightly disfiguring twitch of the face that is almost certainly caused by Ritalin.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, thank you very much, and I hope you can spread the word even further.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We just have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Dr. Peter Bregan. He is a psychiatrist with private practice. He is also founder, international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, and is a critic, one of the world's perhaps leading critics of the idea of biological psychiatry, particularly of the use of psychiatric drugs. He's the author of a number of books. The one that's on this specific issue is titled Talking Back to Ritalin, that first came out in 98 and now is out in a new revised edition published by Perseus Books. It's in paper, available in the bookstore if you want to read the book. And questions are welcome. We'll keep going and get in as many people as we can in the time.
Yeah, they're great questions. Great call-ins.
Let's take next a caller in Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting program. A few callers back, I heard your speaker, just a minute, use the term mentally ill, that people, either doctors or school people or something, had thought that these children were mentally ill. Did you really mean mentally ill?
Actually, I don't use that phrase. If I did, I was speaking from my evil twin.
I think I said it's probably
a class for the severely emotionally disturbed, and that's just the technical educational term.
Yeah. Well,
I don't think
the term mental illness
is a good term at all, because it implies that a lot of problems are somehow physical and biological when they're not. And I just talked about really disturbed kids.
Right. I understand that. But when you use this term, I kind of...
Well, I don't remember using it. If I did, it was a terrible slip of the tongue.
The second thing is, I'm thinking about our local Urbana schools, and I'm sure you don't have any knowledge of them, but the thrust is to include as many children in the class who can be educated in the class in the least restrictive environment. And so we have many, many children who didn't used to be included in the local schools because they were in special classes. Now, if you have a class, I'm thinking about elementary, I've taught elementary, if you have a class of elementary children, 25, 24, 23, and you have 5 or 6 of these overly active, that is, without Ritalin, overly active, acting out, how is a teacher, how do you suggest a teacher can deal with this issue? Because it is an issue.
Mm-hmm. You're asking a very important question. Now, suppose the answer was beating them with a stick. What would you do? What would you say?
I would say, I don't think much of your credentials.
No. Suppose the school district was saying beat them with a stick.
No, I would be going in and marshaling myself with information and...
Against beating with a stick. I think that's just what you should do if you're a teacher with 4, 5, 6 children and somebody wants to put them all on drugs. That you should say, no, I don't do that. I don't want to participate in that.
I'm saying encourage that. These children are not on drugs.
Yeah, I think the caller is saying
what I'm saying is that I would not go ahead and push for drugs. I would do other things, including perhaps getting out there and dealing with the school board and dealing with the community about what you can do in a situation like this. If I had that situation, I would probably say, I can't teach. We need to do something else. We can't go along with a situation where we can't meet the needs of our kids.
Well, many teachers might feel that way, but day in and day out, they're on contract. They are to teach.
What do you think they should do? I mean,
I'm calling to see what.
Well, there is no answer to situations where teachers are put in intolerable circumstances.
Okay.
Now, what they can learn new techniques for dealing with kids. There are books about it. Teachers aren't well trained in it, but I wouldn't want to be trying to teach a classroom of 25 kids where 5 of them were really, really upset kids that can't calm down no matter how wonderful a teacher you are. I wouldn't want to coach a football team like that or a basketball team or a Boy Scouts. And when teachers are put in situations that are intolerable, which is, I assume, what you're trying to say.
That's what I am saying, but maybe
not. And you refuse to teach or you go work with the school board, or you ask to set up a volunteer director and get lots of people from the community into the classroom to help you. You need to just take seriously meeting the needs of the kids and refuse to go along with the chemical club the way we used to maybe use the paddle.
I appreciate those long-run solutions. What does the teacher do the next day when none of those things has come to fruition yet?
Well,
How?
Are you the teacher, can I ask?
Yes. Beg pardon?
Are you the teacher?
I have been. I am not now, no.
I don't think there is a very good solution for it.
Okay.
You know, you could go, the first thing you need is more people in the classroom. So maybe the very shortest term solution, if it were allowed, would be to say, I want to go to my local church and get some help in this classroom on a volunteer basis from some retired people. I want to get some college students in here to help because this is not a good situation for me or the children.
Okay. I appreciate your response, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks. We'll try to get one more at least. This is also Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yes, hello. Wonderful program. Just a quick comment. I am a proponent that sometimes medical research in particular, and sometimes scientific research, but anyway, dealing with humans, take a short-term attitude and forget to include millions of years of evolution and how something like what we call ADHD might have been useful to, you know, a tribe of people out in the savannah and how artificial the environment of a classroom is, especially with boys. Just take, you know, young boys who are used to climbing around and a little more robust maybe, you know, in a situation where they have to sit still. I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, clearly, if you look at evolution, there is no indigenous people, no pre-industrial people who took 30 of their kids, sat them in the middle of the tribe all day long to listen to some elder lecturing and not letting them go out and play in the fields and in the woods and do all the other things they wanted to do. The old phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, is certainly true. And we're trying to raise our kids with no village at all, with one parent family or both parents working, teachers with 25 kids. And it just doesn't work. Now, the part I don't quite agree with is, maybe you weren't saying this, but often there's an implication that we grew in evolution to have certain kinds of people who are no longer appropriate people, these overactive, these aggressive people. Boy, oh boy, do we ever need those kind of people? I mean, we need our boys to be strong. We need them to be able to stand up for themselves. We need our girls to be able to do the same thing. And we need a wide range of people. In fact, modern times, in the last 20 years, perhaps more than ever, has made room for people to make a very good living and a contribution without having to be well-adjusted at all, working at home, working on computers. Some of the, perhaps the world, wealthiest man in the world is hardly an example of your conformist, well-adjusted kid, you know, who always did what he was told. More and more, we need to recognize that we need all the varieties of the human spirit. And what we're doing instead is we're drugging the most challenging spirits growing up in our homes and our schools.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. I want to say, Dr. Bragan, thanks very much for talking
thanks
with us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a wonderful show. I'm really delighted to be on.
Our guest, Peter Bragan. Again, he is the founder and international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. He has many books out on the topics that we've touched on. The one that we just mentioned this morning is titled Talking Back to Ritalin, and it is out now in a revised edition. It's published by Perseus Books.